She takes me to Roach's Stores and buys me a shirt, a gansey, a pair of short pants, two pairs of stockings, and a pair of summer shoes on sale. She gives me 2 shillings to have tea in a bun for my birthday. She gets on the bus to go back up O'Connell Street, too fat and lazy to walk. Fat and lazy, no son of her own, and still she buys me the clothes for my new job. I turn towards Arthur's Quay with a package of new clothes under my arm, and I have to stand at the edge of the River Shannon so that the whole world won't see the tears of a man the day he's 14. Monday morning, I'm up early to wash my face and flatten my hair with water and spit. The abbot sees me in my new clothes. "Jesus," he says, "is it getting married you are?" And goes back to sleep. Mrs. O'Connell, the fat woman, says, "Well, well, aren't we the height of fashion?" And the thin one, Miss Barry, says, "Did you rob a bank on the weekend?" And there's a great laugh from the telegram boy sitting on the bench along the wall. I'm told to sit at the end of the bench and wait for my turn to go out with telegrams. Some telegram boys in uniforms are the permanent ones who took the exam. They can stay in the post office forever if they like. Take the next exam for postman, and then the one for clerk that lets them work inside selling stamps and money orders behind the counter downstairs. The post office gives permanent boys big waterproof capes for the bad weather, and they get 2 weeks' holiday every year. Everyone says these are good jobs, steady and pensionable and respectable. And if you get a job like this, you never have to worry again in your whole life, so you don't. Temporary telegram boys are not allowed to stay in the job beyond the age of 16. There are no uniforms, no holidays, the pay is less, and if you stay out sick a day, you can be fired. No excuses. There are no waterproof capes. Bring your own raincoat or dodge the raindrops. Mrs. O'Connell calls me to her desk to give me a black leather belt and pouch. She says there's a great shortage of bicycles, so I'll have to walk my first batch of telegrams. I'm to go to the farthest address first, work my way back, and don't take all day. She's long enough in the post office to know how long it takes to deliver 6 telegrams, even by foot. I'm not to be stopping in pubs or bookies or even home for a cup of tea, and if I do, I'll be found out. I'm not to be stopping in chapels to say a prayer. If I have to pray, do it on the hoof or on the bicycle. If it rains, pay no attention, deliver the telegrams, and don't be a sissy. 1 telegram is addressed to Mrs. Clohessy of Arthur's Quay, and that couldn't be anyone but Paddy's mother. "Is that you, Frankie McCourt?" she says. "God, I wouldn't know you, you're that big. Come in, will you?" She's wearing a bright frock with flowers all over and shiny new shoes. There are 2 children on the floor playing with a toy train. On the table there's a teapot, cups with saucers, a bottle of milk, a loaf of bread, butter, jam. There are 2 beds over by the window where there were none before. The big bed in the corner is empty, and she must know what I'm wondering. "He's gone," she says. "But he's not dead. Gone to England with Paddy." "Have a cup of tea and a bit of bread. You need it, God help us. You look like one left over from the famine itself. Eat that bread and jam and build yourself up. Paddy always talked about you and Dennis, my poor husband that was in the bed. Never got over that day your mother came and sang the song about the Kerry dancing. He's over in England now making sandwiches in a canteen and sending me a few bob every week. You'd wonder what the English are thinking about when they take a man that has the consumption and give him a job making sandwiches. Paddy has a grand job in a pub in Cricklewood, which is in England. Dennis would still be here if it wasn't for Paddy climbing the wall for the tongue." "Tongue?" "Dennis had the craving, so he did, for a nice sheep's head with a bit of cabbage and a spud, so up with me to Barry the butcher with the last few shillings I had. I boiled that head, and sick and all as he was, Dennis couldn't wait for it to be done. He was a demon there in the bed calling for the head, and when I gave it to him on the plate, he was delighted with himself, sucking the marrow out of every inch of that head. Then he finishes and he says, 'Mary, where's the tongue?' What tongue, says I? The tongue of the sheep. Every sheep is born with a tongue that lets him go ba, 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 and there's a great lack of tongue in his head. Go up to Barry the butcher and demand it. So, up with me to Barry the butcher, and he said, that bloody sheep came in here bleating and crying so much, we cut the tongue from her and thrown it to the dog, who gobbled it up and ever since ba ba's like a sheep, and if he doesn't quit, I'll cut his tongue and throw it to the cat. Back I go to Dennis, and he gets frantic in the bed. I want that tongue, he says. All the nourishment is in the tongue. And what do you think happens next but my Paddy, that was your friend, goes up to Barry the butcher after dark, climbs the wall, cuts the tongue of a sheep's head that's on a hook on the wall, and brings it back to his poor father in the bed. Of course I have to boil that tongue with salt galore, and Dennis, God love him, eats it, lies back in the bed a minute, throws back the blanket and stands out on his 2 feet, announcing to the world that consumption or no consumption, he's not going to die in that bed. If he's going to die at all, it might as well be under a German bomb with him making a few pounds for his family instead of whining in the bed there beyond. She shows me a letter from Paddy. He's working in his Uncle Anthony's pub 12 hours a day, 25 shillings a week, and every day, soup and a sandwich. He's delighted when the Germans come over with the bombs so that he can sleep while the pub is closed. At night he sleeps on the floor of the hallway upstairs. He'll send his mother £2 every month, and he's saving the rest to bring her and the family to England, where they'll be much better off in one room in Cricklewood than 10 rooms in Arthur's Quay. She'll be able to get a job, no bother. You'd have to be a sad case not to be able to get a job in a country that's at war, especially with Yanks pouring in and spending money right and left. Paddy himself is planning to get a job in the middle of London, where Yanks leave tips big enough to feed an Irish family of 6 for a week. Mrs. Claus, he says, we have enough money for food and shoes at last, thanks be to God and his blessed mother. You'll never guess who Paddy met over there in England, 14 years of age and working like a man. Brendan Kiley, the one you used to call Question. Working he is and saving so he can go and join the Mounties and ride all over Canada like at Nelson Eddy singing, if it wasn't for Hitler, we'd all be dead. And isn't that a terrible thing to say? And how's your poor mother, Frankie? She's grand, Mrs. Clossy. No, she's not. I seen her in the dispensary, and she looks worse than my Dennis did in the bed. You have to mind your poor mother. You look desperate too, Frankie, with him 2 red eyes staring out of your head. Here's a little tip for you, threepence. Buy yourself a sweet. I will, Mrs. Clossy. Do. At the end of the week, Mrs. O'Connell hands me the first wages of my life, £1. My first pound. I run down the stairs and up to O'Connell Street, the main street, where the lights are on and people are going home from work. People like me with wages in their pockets. I want them to know I'm like them. I'm a man. I have £1. I walk up one side of O'Connell Street and down the other and hope they'll notice me. They don't. I want to wave my pound out at the world so they'll say, there he goes, Frankie McCourt, the working man with the pound in his pocket. It's Friday night and I can do anything I like. I can have fish and chips and go to the Lyric Cinema. No, no more Lyric. I don't have to sit up in the gods anymore with people all around me cheering on the Indians, killing General Custer and the Africans chasing Tarzan all over the jungle. I can go to the Savoy Cinema now, pay 6 pence for a seat down front where there's a better class of people eating boxes of chocolates and covering their mouths when they laugh. After the film, I can have tea and buns in the restaurant upstairs. Michael is across the street calling me. He's hungry and wonders if there's any chance he could go to the Abbott's for a bit of bread and stay there for the night instead of going all the way to Lemon Griffin's. I tell him he doesn't have to worry about a bit of bread. We'll go to the Coliseum Cafe and have fish and chips, all he wants, lemonade galore, and then we'll go to see Yankee Doodle Dandy with James Cagney and eat 2 big bars of chocolate. After the film, we have tea and buns and we sing and dance like Cagney all the way to the Abbott's. Michael says it must be great to be in America where people have nothing else to do but sing and dance. He's half asleep. But he says he's going there someday to sing and dance. And would I help him go? And when he's asleep, I start thinking about America and how I have to save money from my fare instead of squandering it on fish and chips and tea and buns. I'll have to save a few shillings from my pound, because if I don't, I'll be in Limerick forever. I'm 14 now, and if I save something every week, surely I should be able to go to America by the time I'm 20. There are telegrams for offices, shops, factories, where there's no hope of a tip. Clerks take the telegrams without a look at you or a thank you. There are telegrams for the respectable people with maids along the Innes Road and the North Circular Road, where there's no hope of a tip. Maids are like clerks. They don't look at you or say thank you. There are telegrams for the houses of priests and nuns, and they have maids too, even if they say poverty is noble. If you waited for tips from priests or nuns, you'd die on their doorstep. There are telegrams for people miles outside the city, farmers with muddy yards and dogs who want to eat your legs. There are telegrams for rich people in big houses with gate lodges and miles of land surrounded by walls. The gatekeeper waves you in, and you have to cycle for miles up long drives past lawns, flower beds, fountains to reach the big house. If the weather is fine, people are playing croquet, the Protestant game, or strolling around, talking and laughing, all decked out in flowery dresses and blazers with crests and golden buttons, and you'd never know there was a war on. There are Bentleys and Rolls Royces parked outside the great front door, where a maid tells you to go round to the servants' entrance. Don't you know any better? People in the big houses have English accents, and they don't tip telegram boys. The best people for tips are widows, Protestant ministers' wives, and the poor in general. Widows know when the telegram money order is due from the English government, and they wait by the window. You have to be careful if they ask you in for a cup of tea, because one of the temporary boys, Scrobby Luby, said an old widow of 35 had him in for tea and tried to take down his pants, and he had to run out of the house, though he was really tempted, and had to go to confession the next Saturday. He said it was very awkward hopping up on the bike with his thing sticking out, but if you cycle very fast and think of the sufferings of the Virgin Mary, you'll go soft in no time. Protestant ministers' wives would never carry on like Scrobby Luby's old widow unless they're widows themselves. Christy Wallace, who's a permanent telegram boy and ready to be a postman any day, says Protestants don't care what they do, even if they're ministers' wives. They're doomed anyway, so what does it matter if they have a bit of a romp with the telegram boy? All the telegram boys like Protestant ministers' wives. They might have maids, but they answer the door themselves and say, "One moment, please," and give you sixpence. I'd like to talk to them and ask them how it feels to be doomed, but they might get offended and take back the sixpence. The Irishmen working in England send their telegram money orders on Friday nights and all day Saturday, and that's when we get the good tips. The minute we deliver one batch, we're out with another. The worst lanes are in the Irish town, off High Street or Mungret Street, worse than Roden Lane or O'Keefe's Lane or any lane I lived in. There are lanes with channels running down the middle. Mothers stand at doors and yell Gardy Lou when they empty their slop buckets. Children make paper boats or float matchboxes with little sails on the greasy water. When you ride into a lane, the children call out, "Here's the telegram boy, here's the telegram boy." They run to you, and the women wait at the door. If you give a small child a telegram for his mother, he's the hero of the family. Little girls know they're supposed to wait till the boys get their chance, though they can get the telegram if they have no brothers. Women at the door will call to you that they have no money now, but if you're in this lane tomorrow, knock on the door for your tip. God bless you and all belonging to you. Mrs. O'Connell and Miss Barry at the post office tell us every day our job is to deliver telegrams and nothing else. We are not to be doing things for people, going to the shop for groceries or any other kind of message. They don't care if people are dying in the bed. They don't care if people are legless, lunatic, or crawling on the floor. We are to deliver the telegram, and that's all. Mrs. O'Connell says, "I know everything ye do, everything, for the people of Limerick have their eye on ye, and there are reports which I have here in my drawers." "A fine place to keep reports," says Toby Mackey under his breath. But Mrs. O'Connell and Miss Barry don't know what it's like in the lane when you knock on a door and someone says, come in. And you go in, and there's no light, and there's a pile of rags and a bed in a corner. The pile saying, who is it? And you say, telegram. And the pile of rags tells you, would you ever go to the shop for me? I'm starving with the hunger, and I'd give me 2 eyes for a cup of tea. And what are you going to do? Say, I'm busy, and ride off on your bike, and leave the pile of rags there with the telegram money order that's pure useless, because the pile of rags is helpless to get out of the bed to go to the post office to cash the bloody money order. What are you supposed to do? You're told, never, never go to the post office to cash one of those money orders for anyone, or you'll lose your job forever. But what are you supposed to do when an old man that was in the Boer War hundreds of years ago says his legs are gone, and he'd be forever grateful if you'd go to Paddy Considine in the post office and tell him the situation, and Paddy will surely cash the money order and keep 2 shillings for yourself, grand boy that you are? Paddy Considine says, no bother, but don't tell anyone, or I'd be out me arse, and so would you, son. The old man from the Boer War says he knows you have telegrams to deliver now, but would you ever come back tonight and maybe go to the shop for him, for he doesn't have a thing in the house and he's freezing on top of it. He sits in an old armchair in the corner, covered with bits of blanket, and a bucket behind the chair that stinks enough to make you sick. And when you look at that old man in the corner, you want to get a hose with hot water and strip him and wash him down and give him a big feed of rashers and eggs and mashed potatoes with loads of butter, salt and onions. I want to take the man from the Boer War and the pile of rags in the bed and put them in a big sunny house in the country with birds chirping away outside the window and a stream gurgling. Mrs. Spillane in Pump Lane off Carey's Road has 2 crippled twin children with big blonde heads, small bodies and bits of legs that dangle over the edges of the chairs. They look into the fire all day and say, where's Daddy? They speak English like everybody else, but they babble away to one another in a language they made up. Hung sup tee tee sup hung. Mrs. Spillane says that means, when are we getting our supper? She tells me she's lucky if her husband sends £4 a month, and she's beside herself with the abuse she gets from the dispensary over him being in England. The children are only 4, and they're very bright, even if they can't walk or take care of themselves. If they could walk, if they were any way normal, she'd pack up and move to England out of this godforsaken country that fought so long for freedom, and look at the state of us. De Valera in his mansion above in Dublin, the dirty old bastard, and the rest of the politicians that can all go to hell, God forgive me. The priests can go to hell too, and I won't ask God to forgive me for saying the likes of that. There they are, the priests and the nuns, telling us Jesus was poor and 'tis no shame. Lorries driving up to their houses with crates and barrels of whiskey and wine, eggs galore and legs of ham, and they telling us what we should give up for Lent. Lent my arse. What are we to give up when we have Lent all year long? I want to take Mrs. Spillane and her 2 blonde crippled children and put them in that house in the country with the pile of rags and the man from the Boer War and wash everyone and let them all sit in the sun with the birds singing and the streams gurgling. I can't leave the pile of rags alone with the useless money order because the pile is an old woman, Mrs. Gertrude Daly, all twisted with every class of disease you can get in the Limerick Lane. Arthritis, rheumatism, falling hair, a nostril half gone from her jabbing at it with her finger. And you wonder, what kind of world is it when this old woman sits up from the rags and smiles at you with teeth that gleam white in the dark, her own teeth, and perfect? That's right, she says, me own teeth. And when I rot in the grave, they'll find me teeth 100 years from now, all white and shiny, and I'll be declared a saint. The telegram money order, £3, is from her son. It has a message, happy birthday, Mammy, your fond son, Teddy. She says, wonder he can spare it, the little shit trotting around with every tart in Piccadilly. She asks if I'd ever do her a favour and cash the money order and get her little baby powers whiskey at the pub, a loaf of bread, a pound of lard, 7 potatoes, 1 for each day of the week. Would I boil a potato for her, mash it up with a lump of lard, Give her a cut of bread, bring her a drop of water to go with the whiskey. Would I go to O'Connor the chemist for ointment for her sores, and while I'm at it, bring some soap so she can give her body a good scrub, and she'll be forever grateful and say a prayer for me, and here's a couple of shillings for all my troubles. I know, thanks, ma'am. Take the money, little tip, you did me great favours. I couldn't, ma'am, the way you are. Take the money, or I'll tell the post office you're not to deliver my telegram any more. Oh, all right, ma'am. Thanks very much. Good night, son. Be good to your mother. Good night, Mrs. Daly. School starts in September, and some days Michael stops at the Abbott's before the walk home to Lamb and Griffin's. On rainy days, he says, "Can I stay here tonight?" And soon he doesn't want to go back to Lamb and Griffin's at all. He's worn out and hungry with 2 miles out and 2 miles back. When ma'am comes looking for him, I don't know what to say to her. I don't know how to look at her, and I keep my eyes off to one side. She says, "How's the job?" As if nothing ever happened in Lamb and Griffin's. And I say, "Grand," as if nothing ever happened in Lamb and Griffin's. If the rain is too heavy for her to go home, she stays in the small room upstairs with Alfie. She goes back to Lamb's the next day, but Michael stays, and soon she's moving in herself, bit by bit, till she stops going to Lamb's altogether. The Abbott pays the rent every week. Ma'am gets the relief and the food dockets, till someone informs in her and she's cut off from the dispensary. She's told that if her son is bringing in a pound a week, that's more than some families get on the dole, and she should be grateful he has a job. Now I have to hand over my wages. Ma'am says, "A pound? Is it all you get for riding around in all kinds of weather? This would be $4 in America, $4, and you couldn't feed a cat for $4 in New York. If you were delivering telegrams for Western Union in New York, you'd be earning $25 a week and living in luxury." She always translates Irish money into American so that she won't forget, and tries to convince everyone times were better over there. Some weeks she lets me keep 2 shillings, but if I go to a film or buy a second-hand book, there's nothing left. I won't be able to save for my fare, and I'll be stuck in Limerick till I'm an old man of 25. Malachy writes from Dublin to say he's fed up and doesn't want to spend the rest of his life blowing a trumpet in the army band. He's home in a week, and complains when he has to share the big bed with Michael, Alfie and me. He has his own army cot up there in Dublin with sheets and blankets and a pillow. Now he's back to overcoats and a bolster that sends up clouds of feathers when you touch it. Ma'am says, "Pity about you. I'm sorry for your troubles." The Abbott has his own bed, and my mother has the small room. We're all together again, no lemon tormenting us. We make tea and fried bread and sit on the kitchen floor. The Abbott says, "You're not supposed to be sitting on the kitchen floor. What are tables and chairs for?" He tells ma'am that Frankie is not right in the head, and ma'am says we'll all catch our death from the damp of the floor. We sit on the floor and sing, and ma'am and the Abbott sit on chairs. We sit on the floor and tell stories about things that happened, things that never happened, and things that will happen when we all go to America. There are slow days at the post office, and we sit on the bench and talk. We can talk, but we're not to laugh. Miss Barry says we should be grateful we're getting paid to sit there, bunch of idlers and street boys that we are, and there's to be no laughing. Getting paid for sitting and chatting is no laughing matter. And the first titter out of any of us, and out we go till we come to our senses. And if the tittering continues, we'll be reported to the proper authorities. The boys talk about her under their breath. Toby Mackey says, "What that old bitch needs is a good rub of the relic, a good rub of the brush. Her mother was a street-walking flag-hopper, and her father escaped from a lunatic asylum with bunions on his balls and warts on his wank." There's laughing along the bench, and Miss Barry calls to us. "I warned ye against the laughing. Mackey, what is it you're prattling about over there?" "I said we'd all be better off out in the fresh air on this fine day delivering telegrams, Miss Barry." "I'm sure you did, Mackey. Your mouth is a lavatory. Did you hear me?" I did, Miss Barry. You've been heard on the stairs, Mackie. Yes, Miss Barry. Shut up, Mackie. I will, Miss Barry. Not another word, Mackie. No, Miss Barry. I said shut up, Mackie. All right, Miss Barry. That's the end of it, Mackie. Don't try me. I won't, Miss Barry. Mother of God, give me patience. Yes, Miss Barry. Take the last word, Mackie. Take it, take it, take it. I will, Miss Barry. Toby Mackie is a temporary telegram boy like me. He saw a film called The Front Page, and now he wants to go to America someday and be a tough newspaper reporter with a hat and a cigarette. He keeps a notebook in his pocket because a good reporter has to write down what happens. Facts. He has to write down facts, not a lot of bloody poetry, which is all you hear in Limerick with men in pubs going on about our great sufferings under the English. Facts, Frankie. He writes down the number of telegrams he delivers and how far he travels. We sit on the bench making sure we don't laugh. He tells me that if we deliver 40 telegrams a day, that's 200 a week, and that's 10,000 a year, and 20,000 in our 2 years at the job. If we cycle 125 miles in a week, that's 13,000 miles in 2 years, and that's halfway around the world, Frankie, and no wonder there isn't a scrap of flesh in our arses. Toby says, nobody knows Limerick like the telegram boy. We know every avenue, road, street, terrace, mews, place, close lane. Jesus, says Toby, there isn't a door in Limerick we don't know. We knock on all kinds of doors, iron, oak, plywood. 20,000 doors, Frankie. We rap, kick, push. We ring and buzz bells. We shout and whistle. Telegram boy, telegram boy. We drop telegrams in letterboxes, shove them under doors, throw them over the transom. We climb in windows where people are bedridden. We fight off every dog who wants to turn us into dinner. You never know what's going to happen when you hand people the telegrams. They laugh and sing and dance and cry and scream and fall down in a weakness. And you wonder if they'll wake up at all and give you the tip. It's not a bit like delivering telegrams in America where Mickey Rooney rides around in a film called The Human Comedy and people are pleasant and falling over themselves to give you a tip, inviting you in, giving you a cup of tea and a bun. Toby Mackie says he has facts galore in his notebook and he doesn't give a fiddler's fart about anything. And that's the way I'd like to be myself. Mrs. O'Connell knows I like the country telegrams, and if a day is sunny, she gives me a batch of 10 that will keep me away all morning, and I don't have to return till after the dinner hour at noon. There are fine autumn days when the Shannon sparkles and the fields are green and glinting with silver morning dew. Smoke blows across fields, and there's the sweet smell of turf fires. Cows and sheep graze in the fields, and I wonder if these are the beasts the priest was talking about. I wouldn't be surprised, because there's no end to the bulls climbing on cows, rams on sheep, stallions on mares, and they all have such big things it makes me break out in a sweat to look at them. And I feel sorry for all the female creatures in the world who have to suffer like that, though I wouldn't mind being a bull myself, because they can do what they like, and it's never a sin for an animal. I wouldn't mind going at myself here, but you never know when a farmer might come along the road driving cows and sheep to a fair or to another field, raising his stick and bidding you, good day, young fella, grand morning, thank God and his blessed mother. A farmer that religious might be offended if he saw you breaking the sixth commandment 4 inches to his field. Horses like to stick their heads over fences and hedges to see what's passing by, and I stop and talk to them because they have big eyes and long noses that show how intelligent they are. Sometimes two birds will be singing to each other across a field, and I have to stop and listen to them. And if I stay long enough, more birds will join till every tree and bush is alive with birdsong. If there's a stream gurgling under a bridge on the road, birds singing and cows mooing and lambs baying, that's better than any band in a film. The smell of dinner bacon and cabbage wafting from a farmhouse makes me so weak with the hunger, I climb into a field and stuff myself with blackberries for half an hour. I stick my face into the stream and drink icy water that's better than the lemonade in any fish and chip shop. When I'm finished delivering the telegrams, there's enough time to go to the ancient monastery graveyard where my mother's relations are buried, the Guilfoyles and the Sheehans, where my mother wants to be buried. I can see from here the high ruins of Carrigagunnel Castle, and there's plenty of time to cycle there. Sit up on the highest wall, look at the Shannon flowing out to the Atlantic on its way to America, and dream of the day I'll be sailing off myself. The boys at the post office tell me I'm lucky to get the Carmody family telegram, a shilling tip, one of the biggest you'll ever get in Limerick. So why am I getting it? I'm the junior boy. They say, well, sometimes Teresa Carmody answers the door. She has the consumption, and they're afraid of catching it from her. She's 17, in and out of the sanatorium, and she'll never see 18. The boys at the post office say sick people like Teresa know there's little time left, and that makes them mad for love and romance and everything. Everything. That's what the consumption does to you, say the boys at the post office. I cycle through wet November streets, thinking of that shilling tip, and as I turn into the Carmody Street, the bicycle slides out from under me, and I skid along the ground, scraping my face and tearing open the back of my hand. Teresa Carmody opens the door. She has red hair. She has green eyes like the fields beyond Limerick. Her cheeks are bright pink and her skin is a fierce white. She says, "Oh, you're all wet and bleeding." I skidded on my bike. "Come in, and I'll put something on your cuts." I wonder, should I go in? I might get the consumption, and that'll be the end of me. I want to be alive when I'm 15, and I want the shilling tip. "Come in. You'll perish standing there." She puts on the kettle for the tea. Then she dabs iodine on my cuts, and I try to be a man and not whimper. She says, "Oh, you're a great bit of a man. Go into the parlour and dry yourself before the fire. Look, why don't you take off your pants and dry them on the screen of the fire?" "Ah, no. Ah, do. I will." I drape my pants over the screen. I sit there watching the steam rise, and I watch myself rise, and I worry she might come in and see me in my excitement. There she is with a plate of bread and jam and two cups of tea. "Lord," she says, "you might be a scrawny bit of a fellow, but that's a fine boy-o you have there." She puts the plate and the cups on a table by the fire, and there they stay. With her thumb and forefinger, she takes the tip of my excitement and leads me across the room to a green sofa against the wall. And all the time my head is filled with sin and iodine and fear of consumption and the shilling tip and her green eyes. And she's on the sofa, "Don't stop or I'll die." And she's crying and I'm crying, for I don't know what's happening to me. If I'm killing myself, catching consumption from her mouth, I'm riding to heaven, I'm falling off a cliff. And if this is a sin, I don't give a fiddler's fart. We take our ease on the sofa a while till she says, "Don't you have more telegrams to deliver?" And when we sit up, she gives a little cry. "Oh, I'm bleeding. What's up with you?" I think it's because it's the first time. I tell her, "Wait a minute." I bring the bottle from the kitchen and splash the iodine on her injury. She leaps from the sofa, dances around the parlour like a wild one, and runs into the kitchen to douse herself with water. After she dries herself, she says, "Lord, you're very innocent. You're not supposed to be pouring iodine on girls like that. I thought you were cut." For weeks after that, I deliver the telegram. Sometimes we have the excitement on the sofa, but there are other days she has the cough, and you can see the weakness on her. She never tells me she has the weakness. She never tells me she has the consumption. The boys at the post office say I must be having a great time with the shilling tip and Teresa Carmody. I never tell them I stopped taking the shilling tip. I never tell them about the green sofa and the excitement. I never tell them of the pain that comes when she opens the door and I can see the weakness on her. And all I want to do then is to make tea for her and sit with my arms around her on the green sofa.
One Saturday, I'm told to deliver the telegram to Teresa's mother at her job in Woolworths. I try to be casual. Mrs. Carmody, I always deliver the telegram to your, I think, your daughter, Teresa.
Yes, she's in the hospital.
Is she in the sanatorium?
I said, she's in the hospital.
She's like everyone else in Limerick, ashamed of the TB, and she doesn't give me a shilling or any kind of tip. I cycle out to the sanatorium to see Teresa. They say you have to be a relation and you have to be adult. I tell them I'm her cousin and I'll be 15 in August. They tell me, go away. I cycle to the Franciscan church to pray for Teresa. St. Francis, would you please talk to God? Tell him it wasn't Teresa's fault. I could have refused that telegram Saturday after Saturday. Tell God Teresa was not responsible for the excitement on the sofa, because that's what the consumption does to you. It doesn't matter anyway, St. Francis, because I love Teresa. I love her as much as you love any bird or beast or fish. And will you tell God take the consumption away, and I promise I'll never go near her again. The next Saturday, they give me the Carmody telegram. From halfway up the street, I can see the blinds are drawn. I could see the black crepe wreath on the door. I could see the white purple line mourning card. I could see beyond the door and walls where Teresa and I tumbled naked and wild on the green sofa. And I know now she's in hell and all because of me. I slipped the telegram under the door and cycled back down to the Franciscan church to beg for the repose of Teresa's soul. I pray to every statue, to the stained glass windows, the stations of the cross. I swear I lead a life of faith, hope and charity, poverty, chastity and obedience. Next day, Sunday, I go to four masses. I do the stations of the cross three times. I say rosaries all day. I go without food and drink. And wherever I find a quiet place, I cry and beg God and the Virgin Mary to have mercy on the soul of Teresa Carmody. On Monday, I follow the funeral to the graveyard on my post office bicycle. I stand behind the tree, a distance from the grave. Mrs. Carmody weeps and moans. Mr. Carmody snuffles and looks puzzled. The priest recites the Latin prayers and sprinkles the coffin with holy water. I want to go to the priest, to Mr. and Mrs. Carmody. I want to tell them how I'm the one who sent Teresa to hell. They could do whatever they like with me, abuse me, revile me, throw grave dirt at me. But I stay behind the tree till the mourners leave and the grave diggers fill in the grave. Frost is already whitening the fresh earth on the grave, and I think of Teresa cold in the coffin, the red hair, the green eyes. I can't understand the feelings going through me, but I know that with all the people who died in my family, and all the people who died in the lanes around me, and all the people who left, I never had a pain like this in my heart, and I hope I never will again. It's getting dark. I walk my bicycle out of the graveyard. I have telegrams to deliver. Mrs. O'Connell gives me telegrams to deliver to Mr. Harrington, the Englishman with the dead wife that was born and bred in Limerick. The boys at the post office say sympathy telegrams are a waste of time. People just cry and moan with the grief, and they think they're excused from the tip. They'll ask you if you'd like to come in for a look at the departed and a prayer by the bed. That wouldn't be so bad if they offered you a drop of sherry and a ham sandwich. Oh, no, they're happy to get your prayer, but you're only a telegram boy, and you're lucky if you get a dry biscuit. Older boys at the post office say you have to play your cards right to get the grief tip. If you're asked in to say a prayer, you have to kneel by the corpse, give a powerful sigh, bless yourself, drop your forehead to the bedclothes so they won't see your face, let your shoulders shake like one collapsing with sorrow, hold on to the bed with your two hands, as if they're going to have to tear you away to deliver the rest of your telegrams. Make sure your cheeks are glinting with tears or the spit you dabbed on. And if you don't get a tip after all that, push the next batch of telegrams under the door or fire them over the transom and leave them to their grief. This isn't my first time delivering telegrams to the Harrington house. Mr. Harrington is always away on business for the insurance company, and Mrs. Harrington is generous with the tip. But she's gone, and Mr. Harrington answers the doorbell. His eyes are red and he sniffles. He says, "Are you Irish?" "Irish? What else would I be standing there on his doorstep in Limerick with a batch of telegrams in my hand?" "I am, sir." He says, "Come in. Put the telegrams on the hall stand." He shuts the hall door, locks it, puts the key in his pocket, and I think, aren't Englishmen very peculiar? "You'll want to see her, of course. You'll want to see what you people have done to her with your damn tuberculosis race of ghouls. Follow me." He leads me first to the kitchen, where he picks up a plate of ham sandwiches and two bottles, and then upstairs. Mrs. Harrington looks lovely in the bed, blonde, pink, peaceful. "This is my wife. She may be Irish, but she doesn't look it, thank God. Like you, Irish. You'll need a drink, of course. You Irish quaff at every turn. Barely weaned before you clamour for the whiskey bottle, the pint of stout. You'll have what? Whiskey? Sherry? A lemonade will be lovely. I am mourning my wife not celebrating the bloody citrus. You'll have a sherry. Swill from bloody Catholic fascist Spain." I gulp the sherry. He refills my glass and goes to refill his own with whiskey. "Damn! Whiskey all gone. Stay here, do you hear me? I'm going to the pub for another bottle of whiskey. Stay till I come back. Don't move." I'm confused, dizzy from the sherry. I don't know what you're supposed to do with grieving Englishmen. "Mrs. Harrington, you look lovely in the bed, but you're a Protestant, already doomed in hell like Teresa. Priest said, outside the church there is no salvation." "Wait. I might be able to save your soul. Baptize you Catholic. Make up for what I did to Teresa. I'll get some water. Oh, God, the door is locked. Why? Maybe you're not dead at all. Watching me. Are you dead, Mrs. Harrington? I'm not afraid. Your face is icy. Oh, you're dead, all right. I'll baptize you with sherry from bloody Catholic fascist Spain. I baptize thee in the name of the Father, the Son, the..." "What the bloody hell are you doing? Get off my wife, you wretched papist twit. What primitive paddy ritual is this? Did you touch her? Did you? I'll wring your scrawny neck."
I,
speak English, you scrap."
"I was just a little sherry to get her into heaven."
"Heaven? We had heaven, and I, our daughter Emily. You'll never lay your pink piggy eyes on her. Oh, Christ, I can't stand it. Here, more sherry."
I no thanks.
"And no thanks, that puny Celtic wine. You people love your alcohol, helps you crawl and whine better. Of course you want food. You have the collapsed look of a starving paddy. Here, ham. Eat."
"I no thanks.
And no thanks. Say that again and I'll ram the ham up your ass." He waves a ham sandwich at me, with the heel of his hand pushes it into my mouth. He collapses into a chair. "Oh, God, God, what am I to do? Must rest a moment." My stomach heaves. I rush to the window, stick my head out and throw up. He leaps from the chair and charges me.
You, God blast you to hell, you vomited on my wife's rosebush."
He lunges at me, misses, falls to the floor. I climb out the window, hang onto the ledge. He's at the window, grabbing at my hands. I let go, drop to the rosebush, into the ham sandwich and sherry I've just thrown up. I'm pricked by rose thorns, stung. My ankle is twisted. He's at the window, barking, "Come back here, you Irish runt." He'll report me to the post office. He hits me in the back with the whiskey bottle, pleads,
"Will you not watch 1 hour with me?"
He pelts me with sherry glasses, whiskey glasses, assorted ham sandwiches, items from his wife's dressing table, powders, creams, brushes. I climb on my bike and wobble through the streets of Limerick, dizzy with sherry and pain. Mrs. O'Connell attacks me.
7 telegrams, 1 address, and you're gone all day.
I was...
You was, drunk as what you was, drunk as what you are, reeking. All we heard, that nice man rang, Mr. Harrington, lovely Englishman that sounds like James Mason, let you in to say a prayer for his poor wife, and next thing you're out the window with the sherry and the ham. Your poor mother, what she brought into the world. He made me eat the ham, drink the sherry. Made you. Jesus, that's a good one. Made you. Mr. Harrington is a refined Englishman, and there's no reason for him to lie. And we don't want your kind in this post office. People that can't keep their hands off the ham and sherry. So, hand in your telegram pouch and bicycle, for your days are done in this post office.
But I need the job. I have to save and go to America.
America? Sad day when America lets in the likes of you.
I hobble through the streets of Limerick. I'd like to go back and throw a brick through Mr. Harrington's window. No, respect for the dead. I'll go across the Sarsfield Bridge and out the river bank where I can lie down somewhere in the bushes. I don't know how I can go home and tell my mother I lost my job. Have to go home. Have to tell her. Can't stay out the river bank all night. She'd be frantic. Ma'am begs the post office to take me back. They say, no. They never heard the likes. Telegram boy mauling corpse. Telegram boy fleeing scene with ham and sherry. He will never set foot in the post office again. No. She gets a letter from the parish priest. Take the boy back, says the parish priest. Oh yes, father, indeed, says the post office. They'll let me stay till my 16th birthday. Not a minute longer. Besides, says Mrs. O'Connell, when you think of what the English did to us for 800 years, that man had no right to complain over little ham and sherry. Compare a little ham and sherry to the Great Famine, and where are you? If my poor husband was alive and I told him what you did, he'd say you struck a blow, Frank McCourt. Struck a blow. Every Saturday morning, I swear I'll go to confession and tell the priest of my impure acts at home, on lonely boreens around Limerick with cows and sheep gawking, on the heights of Carrigogunnel with the world looking up. I'll tell him about Teresa Carmody and how I sent her to hell, and that will be the end of me, driven from the church. Teresa is a torment to me. Every time I deliver a telegram to her street, every time I pass the graveyard, I feel the sin growing in me like an abscess. And if I don't go to confession soon, I'll be nothing but an abscess riding around on a bicycle with people pointing and telling each other, there he is, there's Frankie McCourt, the dirty thing that sent Teresa Carmody to hell. I look at people going to communion on Sundays, everyone in a state of grace, returning to their seats with God in their mouths, peaceful, easy, ready to die at any moment and go straight to heaven, or go home to their rashers and eggs without a worry in the world. I'm worn out from being the worst sinner in Limerick. I want to get rid of this sin and have rashers and eggs and no guilt, no torment. I want to be ordinary. The priests tell us all the time that God's mercy is infinite. But how can any priest give absolution to someone like me, who delivers telegrams and winds up in a state of excitement on a green sofa with a girl dying of the galloping consumption? I cycle all around Limerick with telegrams and stop at every church. I ride from Redemptorists to Jesuits to Augustinians to Dominicans to Franciscans. I kneel before the statue of St. Francis of Assisi and beg him to help me, but I think he's too disgusted with me. I kneel with people in the pews next to confessionals, but when my turn comes, I can't breathe, my heart pounds, my forehead turns cold and clammy, and I run from the church. I swear I'll go to confession at Christmas. I can't. Easter. I can't. Weeks and months pass, and it's a year since Teresa died. I'll go on her anniversary. But I can't. I'm 15 now, and I pass churches without stopping. I'll have to wait till I go to America, where there are priests like Bing Crosby in Going My Way, who won't kick me out of the confessional like Limerick priests. I still have the sin in me, the abscess, and I hope it doesn't kill me entirely before I see the American priest. There's a telegram for an old woman, Mrs. Bridget Finucane. She says,
"How old are you, by?"
15 and a half, Mrs. Finucane.
"Young enough to make a fool of yourself and old enough to know better. Are you smart, by? Are you any way intelligent?"
"I can read and write, Mrs. Finucane."
"Are there people above in the lunatic asylum can read and write? Can you write a letter?"
"I can." She wants me to write letters to her customers. If you need a suit or dress for your child, you can go to her. She gives you a ticket to a shop, and they give you the clothes. She gets a discount and charges you the full price and interest on top. You pay her back weekly. Some of her customers fall behind in their payments, and they need threatening letters. She says,
"I'll give you threepence for every letter you write, and another threepence if it brings a payment. If you want the job, come here on Thursday and Friday nights, and bring your own paper and envelopes."
I'm desperate for that job. I want to go to America. But I have no money for paper and envelopes. Next day, I'm delivering a telegram to Woolworths, and there's the answer. A whole section packed with paper and envelopes. I have no money, so I have to help myself. But how? Two dogs saved the day for me. Two dogs at the door of Woolworths, stuck together after the excitement. They yelp and run in circles. Customers and sales clerks giggle and pretend to be looking someplace else. And while they're busy pretending, I slip paper and envelopes under my sweater, out the door, and off on my bike, far from stuck dogs.
Mrs. Finucane looks suspicious. "That's very fancy stationery you have there, by. Is that your mother's? You'll give that back when you get the money, won't you, by?"
"Oh, I will." From now on, I'm never to come to her front door. There's a lane behind her house, and I'm to come in the back door for fear someone might see me. In a large ledger, she gives me the names and addresses of 6 customers behind in their payments.
"Threaten them, by. Frighten the life out of them."
My first letter. "Dear Mrs. O'Brien, inasmuch as you have not seen fit to pay me what you owe me, I may be forced to resort to legal action. There's your son Michael parading around the world in his new suit, which I paid for, while I myself have barely a crust to keep body and soul together. I'm sure you don't want to languish in the dungeons of Limerick Jail, far from friends and family. I remain yours in litigious anticipation, Mrs. Bridget Finucane." She tells me,
"That's a powerful letter, by, better than anything you'd read in the Limerick Leader. That word, inasmuch, that's a holy terror of a word. What does it mean?"
"I think it means this is your last chance." I write 5 more letters, and she gives me money for stamps. On my way to the post office, I think, why should I squander money on stamps when I have 2 legs to deliver the letters myself in the dead of night? When you're poor, a threatening letter is a threatening letter, no matter how it comes in the door. I run through the lanes of Limerick, shoving letters under doors, praying no one will see me. The next week, Mrs. Finucane is squealing with joy.
4 of them paid. Oh, sit down now and write more, by. Put the fear of God in them.
Week after week, my threatening letters grow sharper and sharper. I begin to throw in words I hardly understand myself.
"Dear Mrs. O'Brien, inasmuch as you have not succumbed to the imminence of litigation in our previous epistle, be advised that we are in consultation with our barrister above in Dublin."
Next week, Mrs. O'Brien pays.
"She came in trembling with tears in her eyes, by, and she promised she'd never miss another payment."
On Friday nights, Mrs. Finucane sends me to the pub for a bottle of sherry.
"You're too young for sherry, by. You can make yourself a nice cup of tea, but you have to use the tea leaves left over from this morning. No,
You can't have a piece of bread with the prices they're charging. Bread, is it? Next thing you'll be asking for an egg.
She rocks by the fire, sipping her sherry, counting the money in the purse in her lap, entering payments in her ledger before she locks everything in the trunk under her bed upstairs. After a few sherries, she tells me what a lovely thing it is to have a little money, so you can leave it to the church for masses to be said for the repose of your soul. It makes her so happy to think of priests saying masses for her, years and years after she's dead and buried. Sometimes she falls asleep, and if the purse drops to the floor, I help myself to an extra few shillings for the overtime and the use of all the big new words. There would be less money for the priests than their masses, but how many masses does a soul need? And surely I'm entitled to a few pounds after the way the church slammed doors in my face. They wouldn't let me be an altar boy, a secondary school pupil, a missionary with the White Fathers. I don't care. I have a post office savings account, and if I keep writing successful threatening letters, helping myself to the odd few shillings from her purse, and keeping the stamp money, I'll have my escape money to America. If my whole family dropped from the hunger, I wouldn't touch this money in the post office. Often I have to write threatening letters to neighbors and friends of my mother, and I worry they might discover me. They complain to Mam.
That old bitch Finucane below in Irish Town sent me a threatening letter. What kind of demon out of hell would torment her own kind with a class of a letter that I can't make head nor tail of anyway, with words never heard on land or sea? The person that would write that letter is worse than Judas or any informer for the English.
My mother says anyone that writes such letters should be boiled in oil and have his fingernails pulled out by blind people. I'm sorry for their troubles, but there's no other way for me to save the money for America. I know that someday I'll be a rich Yank and send home hundreds of dollars, and my family will never have to worry about threatening letters again. Some of the temporary telegram boys are taking the permanent exam in August. Mrs. O'Connell says,
"You should take the exam, Frank McCourt. You have a bit of a brain in your head, and you pass it, no bother. You'd be a postman in no time and a great help to your poor mother."
Mam says I should take it too, become a postman, save up, go to America and be a postman over there, and wouldn't that be a lovely life? I'm delivering a telegram to South's pub on a Saturday, and Uncle Pat Keating is sitting there, all black as usual. He says,
"Have a lemonade there, Frankie. Or is it a pint you want now that you're near 16?
"Lemonade, Uncle Pa, thanks."
"You'll want your first pint the day you're 16, won't you?"
"I will, but my father won't be here to get it for me."
"Don't worry about that. I know 'tis not the same without your father, but I'll get you the first pint. 'Tis what I'd do if I had a son. Come here the night before you're 16.
"I will, Uncle Pa."
"I hear you're taking that exam for the post office."
"I am."
"Why would you do a thing like that?"
"'Tis a good job, and I'd be a postman in no time, and it has the pension."
"Ah, pension, my arse. 16 years of age and talking about the pension. Is it codding me you are? Do you hear what I said, Frankie? Pension, my arse. If you pass the exam, you'll stay in the post office nice and secure the rest of your life. You'll marry a Bridget and have 5 little Catholics and grow little roses in your garden. You'll be dead in your head before you're 30 and dried in your bollocks the year before. Make up your own bloody mind and to hell with the safe shots and the begrudgers. Do you hear me, Frankie McCourt?"
"I do, Uncle Pa. That's what Mr. O'Halloran said."
"What did he say?"
"Make up your own mind."
"True for Mr. O'Halloran. 'Tis your life. Make your own decisions and to hell with the begrudgers, Frankie. In the heel of the hunt, you'll be going to America anyway, won't you?"
"I will, Uncle Pa." The day of the exam, I'm excused from work. There's a sign in an office window on O'Connell Street.
"Smart boy wanted. Neat handwriting. Good at sums. Apply here to manager, Mr. McCaffrey, Eason's Limited."
I stand outside the place of the exam, the house of the Limerick Protestant Young Men's Association. There are boys from all over Limerick climbing the steps to take the exam, and a man at the door is handing them sheets of paper and pencils and barking at them to hurry up, hurry up.